In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, Alarmy. Before we get started, we wanted to make sure you heard the big news. The Alarmist has joined Patreon. Patreon subscribers will get access to our content ad-free, as well as our Aftermath post-interview discussion and final verdict. We'll also be putting out additional bonus episodes and other fun stuff. Here's a preview of Guest Alarmist, where I step aside and let a guest walk us through a personal tragedy, and together the Alarmist crew figures out who's to blame. This month, Leah Poliott discusses the sisterhood of the traveling disaster.
But I do want to say, it's like, what always happens too is that, like, you have these, like, you know, destinations you want to go to, but then something always happens along the way. There's always magic involved.
Yeah, it's the magic.
What's such the bummer is that Leah and Sarah didn't get to kind of find those pockets of magic in their...
Well, did travels. You? We don't know. Was there a magical moment, even though all this chaos was going on, that you guys think about, like, with fond memories?
There were some ravioli that we had when we first got into France.
That's great.
And that is still magical in my heart.
Great.
It was the only place open before dinner. We got in. It was like 3 or 4 at a weird time. Nobody was at this restaurant. Best ravioli I've ever had in my entire life.
Oh.
That's
I'm
great.
So happy for you.
Yeah.
Go to patreon.com/thealarmist and subscribe today. Now, on to our episode.
I was born with a special gift. The ability to mentally transform any situation into the worst case scenario in my own brain. My therapist calls my gift catastrophizing. And that's why I'm uniquely qualified to scrutinize and analyze history's greatest disasters and find out who's to blame. They say history repeats itself. Not on my watch. My name is Rebecca Delgado Smith, and I am the Alarmist.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into The Alarmist, a comedy podcast where we talk about history's greatest tragedies and figure out who's to blame. Today, we're discussing the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. Here's what you need to know. Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, a Boeing 777 jet, took off at 12:42 a.m. on March 8th, 2014. It was a routine trip from Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, to Beijing, China. The beginning of the trip was largely unremarkable, with the pilot in command, Zahari Ahmad Shah, communicating with air traffic control over Malaysian airspace. But at 1:19 a.m., as the plane was about to cross into Vietnamese airspace, Zahari said to the Malaysian air traffic controller, "Good night, Malaysian 370. It would be the final communication heard from anyone on board the jet. The plane did not land on time in Beijing and was reported missing. Despite there being no verbal correspondence coming out of Flight 370 and the transponder being shut down, its flight pattern was tracked through conventional radar, which was able to determine that the plane took a sharp left turn after entering into Vietnamese airspace. It then flew southwest over the Malay Peninsula, then around the island of Penang, and out over the Andaman Sea. At that point, the radar no longer picked up its signal. However, a geostationary Indian Ocean satellite, operated by a private company called Inmarsat, was able to determine the flight flew southward for several hours over the Andaman Sea until it eventually ran out of fuel and crashed into the Indian Ocean between Australia and Antarctica. What followed was the most expensive and extensive plane rescue search in history. A multinational fleet of aircraft and vessels searched the waters surrounding the path the plane was thought to have taken. And despite several pieces of the plane churning up on shores over the course of the next several years, the majority of the airplane remains missing. The actual events that transpired on Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 and what happened the hours after their final communication remain a mystery to this day and have been a source of speculation worldwide. Fun facts, aka death stats. All 12 crew members, along with 227 passengers from 14 nations, have never been found. 17 minutes passed before officials began searching for the plane. An Australian-led search costing more than $150 million of more than 46,300 square miles of remote Indian Ocean was called off in 2017, 3 years after the crash. The search involved more than 30 countries and 150 ships. The flight code MH370 was retired by Malaysian Airlines days after the plane disappeared, saying it would no longer use it as a mark of respect. No transmissions were received from the aircraft after its first 38 minutes of flight, and systems designed to automatically transmit the flight's position failed to work. The plane's black box, the flight data recorder, has never been found. In 2017, Malaysian Airlines announced that they are the first airline to sign up for a new service that would track its airplanes anywhere in the world using orbiting satellites. With us today, we have producer Clayton Early.
Hello.
Fact checker Chris Smith.
Hi.
And our very special guest today is friend of the Alarmy, Anastasia Kousakis. Stosh, we're so happy to have you on today.
Oh, thank you for having me back. I'm thrilled to be here.
And you're the perfect person for this particular episode because you have been obsessed with the Malaysian Airlines 370 mystery.
I honestly thought this might be a joke when I was invited to partake because I was like, is she trying to hurt me or do I need this?
This is a Christmas present for you.
I love that you think your first thought is she trying to hurt me.
Well, everybody else in my life right now, mostly my children, are trying to hurt me all the time.
I won't take it personally. But before we jive, we have to ask you, you know, since the last time we saw you, what's recently alarming you? What's keeping you up at night?
What is literally keeping me up at night? Probably perimenopause. Mm. Heart palpitations. How
high does your heart rate go?
I don't actually know the numbers, but I can report back to you in the new year because I have an appointment with a cardiologist coming up because I had to wear a Zio patch, which for a week on my chest, which like measures your heartbeat for that entire period of time. And then all the information goes to your doctor and she and I are having a chat after Christmas. So I'll let you know.
Wow.
So wait, I'm fine. Your doctor is monitoring your heart, right?
Not at this exact moment, but for 7 days in November. Wow. Yes. Whoa.
What does that feel like? Heart palpitations? I don't know if I've had that.
It's like your heart is just like boom, 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 like racing kind of. It's a bit of a race, a bit of an irregular heartbeat.
Okay.
Have you ever been in love, Clayton?
I guess not.
Rebecca, yeah, maybe that's my problem.
Maybe
oh
you're
God,
just in
you're
love.
In love. Yeah.
Congratulations. Oh your doctor's going to tell you all about it after Christmas.
It's a surprise to me.
Mike is going to be either really happy or really sad. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. We'll see.
It would be amazing if your doctor could diagnose you with love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're terminally in love.
There's a new movie about this called Fingerprints on Apple.
Oh.
Anyway, if you guys want to see, that storyline play out.
Are you somehow connected to this?
Yeah.
No, I'm not. I was just sick and watched it in bed.
We hope you get good news in the new year.
Mm-hmm.
And and actually this is going to be coming out in the new year, so who knows, you might already know the outcome of your love.
Your love.
Whether I'm in love. You guys can have an epilogue to the episode.
Right. Well, whether your heart palpitations are in fact love, which is what our first instinct is, whether or not that is true or not, is we don't care. We won't be on the podcast.
Yeah. So wait until the end of the episode and I'll probably say something like, in the next few weeks, Stosh did meet with her medical provider. Who confirmed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Totally, or denied. Totally. Can't wait to find out who the lucky person is.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, that's the net. You're going to have to see a specialist for that.
Yeah, exactly.
So we have to transition and, a lot of people lost loved ones on this plane.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the real tragedy of this mystery. It's actually a mystery, and we don't often do mysteries on The Alarmist because it does make it hard to blame when so many questions are unanswered.
Mm-hmm.
But because it doesn't seem like there will ever be an answer to this tragedy, we're gonna dive in and we're gonna do the best we can.
Right, which is better than any investigating body in history.
Yes. Yeah, they should have given us $150 million or $1 billion or whatever they spent.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, but I was thinking this might be the hardest episode of The Alarmist that has ever happened. Certainly the most difficult episode.
Because of the open-endedness of it?
Yeah, because there's just so many unanswered questions.
Yeah, it's so weird.
On brand though, like I have my theories and I'm pretty sure I know what happened.
Okay.
Okay. Wow.
Well, there you go.
Thank God we have you.
Yeah.
Let's dive in. And how do we do this? There's a few that I feel like are not. They're more conspiracy theories, and just for the record, I feel like everyone should read this Atlantic article that was written, I believe, in 2020 or 2019, and the writer is hold on, let me get this for you, William Languishy. I'm probably not saying that correct, but it's article. It's very long, but it's very thorough, and it comes out after some debris has been found and after some questions have been answered. But the main theory here is perhaps that the pilot was to blame based on this article.
Okay.
I'm just going to read.
So do you want to put the pilot on the board first?
I think we do.
Okay.
I think we do.
Okay.
This is from that Atlantic article. Up in the cockpit that night, while First Officer Farik flew the airplane, Captain Zahari handled the radios. The arrangement was standard. Zahari's transmissions were a bit unusual. At 1:01 a.m., he radioed that they had leveled off at 35,000 feet, a superfluous report in radar-surveilled airspace, where the norm is to report leaving an altitude, not arriving at one. Mm-hmm. At 1:08, the flight crossed the Malaysian coastline and set out across the South China Sea in the direction of Vietnam. Zahari again reported the plane's level at 35,000 feet. 11 minutes later, as the plane closed in on a waypoint near the start of Vietnamese air traffic jurisdiction, the controller at Kuala Lumpur at the center radioed Malaysian 370 contact Ho Chi Minh 120.9. Good night. Zahari answered, good night, Malaysian 370. He did not read back the frequency, as he should have, but otherwise the transmission sounded normal. It was the last word heard from MH370. So very odd. The last words that were ever recorded were, good night, Malaysian 370.
It's chilling.
Yeah. And the weird protocol, like that, not like doing things a little backwards, a little quirky. It's kind of like, what's that all about?
Yes, but well, it didn't ring any alarms at the
time. And I guess like, how could it have, right? Like if it wasn't totally, and what, if it had rung an alarm, what the heck would anybody have done?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
At that moment, it was unclear if even anything
could have been done
to save the situation.
But regardless of whether anything could have been done, what it does indicate is the rationale behind it, which is that it's possible, is what they're saying, it was a murder-suicide, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into that. This is from CBS News.
What, I'm sure there's theories about this. Well, I mean, could that hit be like a coded way of being like, I'm communicating weirdly because I'm hijacked and like, you know what I mean? He's being like forced to talk, so he's saying things a little odd, so people like are kind of like, why is he doing that? Is something like, that's maybe a stretch.
That's a good question.
A good question. Let's dig into that a little bit more. This is from an article from CBS News. 60 Minutes Australia brought together an international group of aviation experts who say that the disappearance of MH370 was a criminal act by veteran pilot Captain Zahiri Ahmad Shah. He was killing himself, unfortunately. He was killing everybody else on board, and he did it deliberately, said Canadian air crash investigator Larry Vance. Boeing 777 pilot and instructor Simon Hardy reconstructed the flight plan based on military radar and says Captain Shaw flew along the border of Malaysia and Thailand, crossing in and out of each country's airspace to avoid detection. The Guardian writes, the incident was a mass murder-suicide plot by Zahari, whose home flight simulators was found to have mapped a similar strange path to the one indicated by radar and satellite data. The route, this is from NPR. I'm reading a lot here, but we'll discuss.
Okay.
This is from NPR. The route was found on the home flight simulator of MH370. 370's pilot Zahari Ahmad Shah. In a session from 6 weeks before MH370's disappearance, the simulator was used to recreate the flight of a Boeing 777, a similar model to the aircraft that was lost. The simulated path took the aircraft from Kuala Lumpur, north of Indonesia, and then south into the southern Indian Ocean. The simulated plane was flown until it ran out of fuel. Shah was off work on the day the simulation was flown, according to records. This is from CBS News. This was a mission by one of the crew to hide the aircraft as far away from civilization as possible, Hardy said. which puts us way outside the search area that is currently being done. The wreckage uncovered so far may be further evidence that the pilot actually had control, that it was not a high-speed crash. As Larry Vance noted of one wing component recovered from the shore of Africa, the front of it would be pressed in and hollow. The water would invade inside and it would explode from the inside. So this piece would not even exist. Okay, there's a lot to unpack here.
Yeah, you just threw a lot at us.
Yes. Why don't we take it one step at a time? Now, this was a veteran pilot. Mm-hmm. His co-pilot was studying. He after this flight, he would have completed all of his hours and would have become a pilot himself. Mm, sure. So they had paired this veteran pilot with what do you call a pilot who's in training?
Trainee.
I don't know.
There's a real term for this.
I'm really trying.
I was going to say a cadet, but that is wrong.
No.
No.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's see here. Sorry.
So, a lot of the information that came out at first from Malaysian authorities was they definitely were not sharing a lot of the intel that they had. They allegedly just said it wasn't the pilot, don't think about it anymore, he was fine, there were no issues. Now, he had recently gone through a divorce. He had he was having an affair with a woman who was I guess married at the time. He was living alone. Like there it wasn't just like this guy was perfect, he was fine. They did find the simulator at his from when they did a search of his home.
So there was circumstantial evidence that may suggest that possibly he was unhappy and he was possibly mm-hmm. he had trained for this essentially, because like mm-hmm. he had taken this flight path in at his home simulator.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and that was a specific detail they left out of that report, right? The path of the simulated flight.
Right. Mm. Did they originally leave that out or did they discover it later?
They left it out. Oh. The Malaysian authorities did when they were reporting their sort of initial findings. Maybe it was the report that came out about a year after the crash, I think. Mm. And they did not include this simulation. I think it was the FBI who ended up finding it and uncovering it. I might be wrong about that, but somebody else who was investigating from another country like found these deleted simulations.
Mm.
And expose them.
And it feels like he could have potentially had the control of the plane, and there are theories about how he did it, which maybe we should jump into that.
Yeah, I'm so curious because what was indicated, right, is that the officer who was training, the pilot who was training is the one who was flying the plane, right, when the plane crossed over into the Vietnamese airspace. And then so he would have had to somehow gain control if he was the one that did this, right? The experienced
captain
pilot.
Zahar, yeah.
Yes, the captain.
Something I heard was that he was known to be very meticulous about his flying. And so it wasn't uncommon for him to send the second officer. Is that what it is? Yeah, the second officer to go see, I don't know, go see something in the back of the plane, like check on whatever. And he could have easily just locked him out of the cabin of the cockpit.
Or like wait, maybe he goes to the bathroom, who knows?
Wait until that.
As they do sometimes, yeah.
It does feel like it was planned and strategic because there was a very short period of time that he had from when they crossed into the Vietnamese airspace. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about that. So.
Wait, sorry. Before we move on.
Yeah.
Was there anything else based on that sort of chunk of pilot information that you gave us that would lead us to want to put more things up on the board? Like, should we put.
Yeah, we only have the captain up right now.
Well, we're going to put Malaysian authorities up on the board, but I want to do some, before we do that, I want to put the air traffic control and talk about that so that we're talking about it in, so we know what is very suspicious about this time.
Okay.
This is, again, from that Atlantic article. The time was 1:21, 39 minutes after takeoff. The controller in Kuala Lumpur was dealing with other traffic elsewhere on his screen and simply didn't notice. When he finally did, he assumed that the plane was in the hands of Ho Chi Minh, somewhere out beyond his range. The Vietnamese controllers, meanwhile, saw MH370 cross into their airspace and then disappear from radar. They apparently misunderstood a formal agreement by which Ho Chi Minh was supposed to inform Kuala Lumpur immediately if an airplane that had been handed off was more than 5 minutes late checking in. They tried repeatedly to contact the aircraft to no avail. By the time they picked up the phone to inform Kuala Lumpur, 18 minutes had passed since MH370's disappearance from the radar screen. What ensued was an exercise in confusion and incompetence. Kuala Lumpur's Aeronautical Rescue Coordination Center could have been notified within an hour of the disappearance. By 2:30 a.m., it still had not been. 4 hours elapsed before an emergency response was finally begun at 6:32 a.m. And that was around the time that the plane was supposed to land in Beijing. So from what I understand, if a plane disappears from the time that it leaves one airspace to the next, in 5 minutes, if that plane you're not seeing it in your radar or whatever, someone has to contact the prior airspace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They waited 18 minutes to contact Kuala Lumpur, mm-hmm. which is almost four times the amount
mm-hmm.
that of the agreement that should have been exercised.
Yeah.
Right.
And is that incompetence, but is there like any evidence of overworked, understaffed, you know, like that kind of stuff where people are missing things? Or is this truly just like they flubbed?
It feels like they were trying to, who knows, if they were just busy. There weren't enough people. Who knows if they were trying to contact the plane and just didn't use the proper protocol. Mm-hmm. But that shouldn't have happened. But the pilot would have known that he at least had those 5 minutes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So should we put up on the board following through on protocol? Not following through on protocol?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah, not following through.
And what they believe is that within those 5 minutes, he would have had to get the second officer out of the cockpit.
Hmm.
Lock himself in the cockpit, take control of the plane, and perhaps either fly higher up to 40,000, above 40,000 feet, and create what they believe was a situation where the passengers died of hypoxia. So,
because they were too like thin air kind of situation, is that what that is?
Yes. Now I'm gonna read again from the Atlantic article.
How would you get off of the radar? Like, how do you get? I mean, isn't that radar's radar? This is where I don't know much about this.
So I believe that the way to do that would be to turn off the electricity on the plane,
mm-hmm.
which seems to be what he might have done.
Wow,
now this is all an assumption. This is all an assumption. I want to put this all under the banner of this is an assumption. If the pilot did it, this is
right.
Right.
This is what would have happened.
Uh huh.
And nobody believes that it would have been the second officer because he probably didn't have the training to do this kind of maneuver that the plane flew in. And he also was like at the beginning of his career, so he would have been mm-hmm. Very excited. This is like a big deal to finally finish your hours and become a pilot for the like Malaysian Airlines, which was a very important job.
Yeah.
I just want to say, I feel like we should not have a situation where any one human being can control whether or not a plane stays on or off radar. Like, that just seems like a real miss on our part. Like it should not, it should just be like built into the plane, like, you know, a black box if there's a crash.
Yeah. Right. So that is, that has to do with the, what is the tracking system within the plane?
Yeah.
It's the
it should be automatic. I mean, this seems like a safety thing because, well, people go rogue sometimes.
People might not know this, but this was something that happened. There was an Air France flight a few years earlier that was lost in the ocean. Mm. And when that happened, people were like, well, where was it in the radar when it went down? And they said, well, there are certain areas when you're flying above the ocean where planes are not actually being tracked.
Oh, my God.
Cool.
Oh, my God.
Right. And in this,
there are dead zones, you know, and by that, I mean, like, there's just areas where you can't put satellites. Like, where do you put a satellite in the middle of the Indian Ocean?
Well, right. It's in
Not a satellite, but like a tower.
Right. Well, we get into here is like how radar and satellites even work, which right. is confusing, but
we're not going to even try to. Yeah.
We already sound and are dumb.
But maybe that's something we can talk about with our guest experts.
Yes.
But why are there dead zones where there are possible flight patterns radar cannot track? Like, how is that possible?
And if you go online and you search for this flight pattern that the plane suddenly took right after he said goodnight, Malaysia 370. Mm-hmm. It's almost like he or the plane goes just backtracks. It turns around from going northeast to going southwest.
Hmm.
It's a sharp turn.
It's a sharp turn.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let me read another section, and please put hypoxia up on the board.
Okay. Okay.
This is an electrical engineer in Boulder, Colorado, named Mike Exner, who is a prominent member of the Independent Group, has studied the radar data extensively. He believes that during the turn, the airplane climbed up to 40,000 feet, which was close to its limit. During the maneuver, the passengers would have experienced some G-forces, that feeling of being suddenly pressed back into the seat. Exner believes the reason for the climb was to accelerate the effects of deep pressurization that the airplane had, causing the rapid incapacitation and death of everyone in the cabin. An intentional deep pressurization would have been an obvious way and probably the only way to subdue a potentially unruly cabin in an airplane that was going to remain in flight for hours to come. In the cabin, the effects would have gone unnoticed, but for the sudden appearance of the drop-down oxygen masks, and perhaps the cabin's crew's use of the few portable units of similar design. None of those cabin masks was intended for more. Oh, this is a shocker. Brace yourself. None of those cabin masks was intended for more than about 15 minutes of use during emergency descents to altitudes below 13,000 feet. They would have been of no value at all cruising at 40,000 feet.
Oh my God. Okay, go ahead. Keep going.
Well, the cabin occupants would have become incapacitated within a couple of minutes, lost consciousness, and gently died without any choking or gasping of air. The scene would have been dimly lit by the emergency lights with the dead belted into their seats, their faces nestled in the worthless oxygen masks dangling on tubes from the ceiling.
I didn't realize that 40,000, because don't you fly around 30,000 feet, like, and 35,000 feet, like, all the time when you're cruising? Like, I feel like the captain's always like, and I'm like,
yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that 40,000 feet it seems we fly pretty close to the ceiling.
Right.
That's scary to me.
I never knew that, yeah. One more thing for me to worry about when I get
No, God.
And the fact that they're only good for 15 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. I guess that makes sense because you're talking about a ton of, I mean, if you need oxygen for all of the passengers, it's hundreds of people, and
right.
There's only so much they can probably carry. I don't know.
Well, and why would you, I guess, like, why would you need to be in this area for that long? You know, like, it's for the descent, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And hopefully you stabilize and then you can get people back on the regular oxygen.
like an emergency landing type of situation or something.
Because you can get down pretty fast if you had to. Like if you had to get to the ground, you could.
Unless you're flying over the ocean.
Yes, you're flying over the ocean. But then you would assume that that you would just fly at a lower altitude.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. I'm reading that the highest or not allowable, but how high is too high for a plane to fly? I asked Google and it said 43,000 feet.
Wow.
So it's true. Feels like we're so close, to that. But I'm sure there's a huge difference in that 5,000 to 8,000 feet.
Sure.
But also, help me understand. Is the theory that the pilot turned on some button or something to depressurize the plane, or is it the feeling that the ascent caused the depressurization, or was it that he pushed a button to or the altitude? I mean,
yeah, the altitude. Right. I think the idea is that he flew up to 40,000 feet. Perhaps the masks would have dropped at some point. Even if people put the masks on, it would have been just a matter of minutes.
Including the pilot, who would have just gently died.
Unless they had an oxygen mask themselves or had prepared for that kind of scenario, because what they believe is that he then flew, putting the plane on autopilot and flying toward the ocean, and the plane would have eventually run out of fuel.
And just crashed into the ocean.
Some theorize that the plane was so high, right, that when it would go down, it would essentially come apart on the way down. So, it wouldn't even have come apart from hitting the water. It would have come apart just before it even hit the water.
So the
'cause I think it was like 600,000 miles per hour.
Nope. Can't be right.
Or maybe 600 miles per hour. It would have gone down at 600 miles per hour.
I'm not sound barrier multiple times.
I'm admittedly not great at math, but I can tell you with pretty good certainty that you're.
Meanwhile, I'm like, yep, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right.
A few decimal points off, perhaps. But okay, so up on the board, we don't have much here. I just want to encourage us to do the podcast we said we were going to do and try and put a few more things up on the board. I know there's just so many sort of moving pieces here, but do we want to put planes flying too high to begin with up on the board?
Flying too high.
I'm just taking stabs in the dark at this point because
too close to the sun. Flying too close to the sun.
Can I also this image of them, sort of the theory of going up to 40,000 feet and then all of the passengers just sort of gently dying?
Yeah.
Without choking or gasping for air. To me, there's something in that which like kind of complements the theory that this was a mass murder suicide. It's like he sort of it doesn't feel like there's a lot of I don't know, sort of chaos. It feels very deliberate.
Yes, I agree.
It's just
a way
speculating.
Of controlling the entire
because the ascension according to this article, also the ascension wouldn't have gone noticed. Like nobody would have noticed except
he said g-force. You would have felt the g-force. You would feel that.
Yeah, just like it looks like we're going fast when the back is
right. Like when you're taking off, and you've kind of pushed into your seat, you're like, oh yeah, you feel that. But that would be if we were like at cruising altitude and suddenly I felt like we were really pushing up high, I'd kind of be like, what are we doing this for?
Right. Oh, I would. The second I felt a single like ounce of G-force, I'd be like, this plane has been hijacked.
You guys might be better passengers than me because I feel like I would trust so much. And maybe that's what we need to sort of examine more closely here. But I just would be like, oh, it's probably normal plane stuff. I don't understand.
Announcement. Maybe he made an announcement like we have to. Well, then he'd be giving himself away to his co-pilot. You know what I mean?
Right.
This is all the speculation.
Right.
There's It just really begs the question of what was the psychological state of this person that wanted to then be on board with like 200 plus dead people flying towards his own death into the middle of nowhere where no one was going to see debris, right. Plane, anything. Like he wanted no one to know anything. Mm. It is so mind-boggling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To not be able to like have an answer or wrap your head around what was actually going on.
Yeah, the psychology behind mass murder suicide is mm-hmm. very disturbing.
Yeah, I know. I remember when this was all happening, I really wanted to jump on board with some of the, conspiracy theories is sort of a loose term, but that writer Jeff Wise, who was writing for New York Magazine, who has the theory that there was a Russian, the Russians took control of the plane or something. And initially, back when the plane had initially disappeared, he was like, you know, hypothesizing that the plane had landed in Russia, and there were like Google images of like warehouses where like there was all this stuff about how the plane had been hijacked and taken away. And I was like, I hope that's what happened. Like, I need mm-hmm. that to be like what happened, as opposed to like
everyone's dead.
Just,
right.
Yeah. And the plane just like literally disappearing is so chilling to me. I can't live with it. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like a lot of the family members held out hope.
Yeah.
For a while, hoping that maybe they were still alive. Maybe the plane had been hijacked. Maybe it was somewhere in Kazakhstan or something.
Yeah.
That it had like maybe it did fall into the jungle in Kazakhstan, because that was another theory.
And it took long for them to find debris, just because they had no idea that it made the turn. I mean, they kind of just didn't know what area it ended up in, right?
This is part of the problem. This is why I feel like we should put the Malaysian government up on the board. The search for the plane was severely delayed in the correct area because the Malaysian government wasn't really sharing a lot of their intel. And so they were searching like in the first 48 hours of the disappearance, mm-hmm. they were searching in the wrong area, and those are mm-hmm. that's a crucial time period, because it's right. really hard to find things in the ocean, as one can imagine, even like when you know where they are.
Yeah,
it's still like a hundreds of miles radius.
Moves.
And you think it'd be in their interest to work with other governments, because it's generally these kind of flights are international flights with citizens from many different countries. So you like, why would they not join share forces? That
okay, well, let's. I want to read a little bit. This is from CBS News. An independent investigation report released Monday, more than 4 years after Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 disappeared, highlighted shortcomings in the government response that exacerbated the mystery. The report reiterated Malaysia's assertion the plane was deliberately diverted and flown for over 7 hours after severing communications. It said the cause of the disappearance still cannot be determined, and the possibility of intervention by a third party cannot be excluded. The Atlantic, this is again from that article, less than a week after the disappearance, the Wall Street Journal published the first report about the satellite transmissions, indicating that the airplane most likely stayed aloft for hours after going silent. Malaysian officials eventually admitted that the account was true. The Malaysian regime was said to be one of the most corrupt in the region. It was also proving itself to be a furtive, fearful, and unreliable in its investigation of the flight. Accident investigators dispatched from Europe, Australia, and the United States were shocked by the disarray they encountered. Because the Malaysians withheld what they knew, the initial sea searches were concentrated in the wrong places, the South China Sea, and found no floating debris. Had the Malaysians told the truth right away, such debris might have been found and used to identify the airplane's approximate location. The black boxes might have been recovered. The underwater search for them ultimately centered on a narrow swath of ocean thousands of miles away. But even a narrow swath of the ocean is a big place. It took 2 years to find the black boxes from Air France 447, which crashed into the Atlantic Ocean on flight from Rio de Janeiro to Paris in 2009. And the searchers had known exactly where to look. So that one took 2 years. They knew where to find it. This, they didn't know where to find it, but they could have at least been closer. And eventually they did find pieces of the plane tracked back to the being actually from the plane because of serial numbers. And they found these pieces off the, I believe they had just come in to the shore off the coast of Africa.
Right. Mm-hmm. So those weren't like found in the sense that they were like looking for those pieces. Right. They just washed up on shore and were
But there were people who were actually expecting that to happen.
Right.
And they were searching for them.
I wonder if there's, this just kind of makes me think of like their response to the Malaysian government. Like, you know, like when you think about like an airline, like every nation, like airlines are kind of like a source of like pride. It like means like you have economic prosperity, you have like security, like way of transporting your citizens. Yeah. And like, it's kind of like a flagship thing of every nation or every like, you know, wealthy nation. So it feels like maybe there's like a sense of like shame or like pride that their flight suddenly, like they couldn't figure out where their plane went kind of thing. So they were like not working with people out of the, I don't know.
Plane pride? You want to call it plane pride?
Yeah, plane pride. But, well, I think that's yeah, I think you're onto something because the airline was actually either half government owned. It was a financial decision to withhold information.
Right.
Absolutely. Because this probably, I mean, I don't know if Malaysian Airlines has even bounced back. I don't know, you know, but like this is a huge financial blow to any airline when something like this happens.
Right.
Well, but to have zero answers. Oof.
I think it went from private. It was private at the time and then it became state owned again, I believe. Oh,
okay.
Okay. But again, investors, you know, I'm sure the stocks would have gone down.
Maybe even the pilot, I don't know, maybe he had a sense that like there would be corruption would infiltrate the investigation and it would allow him to get away with, I don't know, some of this to some extent more than maybe he could have other places if in fact this is what happened. So, I mean, they definitely deserve to be on the board. But
so, you know, what's true, and there's maybe this is how conspiracy theories are born, but it was unprofitable leading up to 2014. Like it was doing really poorly. And they might have needed a push to get it back to what's called, I guess, renationalization. So, you know, bringing it back to the government. So, I mean, there's a conspiracy theory in there. We're not in that business, but it definitely, I mean, you know, dollars and cents.
We can talk about some of the conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I was going to say, we have a small board and we're kind of far into this episode. So what outside of the pilot stuff should we, like, consider?
Well, some people said there was possibly a remote control of the aircraft. Subsequent analysis from military and civilian radar shows that the Boeing 777 aircraft made a series of turns that brought it back over the Malay Peninsula. Investigators believe that the initial turns were deliberate, meaning that someone was controlling the aircraft. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I don't know if this is true. If aircrafts can be controlled
remotely,
like hijacked and remotely controlled. Yeah.
Boy, I hope terrifying. Not.
oh my God.
I thought I heard something that after 9/11, they started coming up with that, with the ability to control an aircraft from outside in order to stop hijackings. That would be the goal.
This seems like very ill-advised. I but what do I know?
No, it's not. It looks like it's they don't allow for that to be built into passenger aircraft, like commercial passenger aircrafts.
Okay.
I mean, doesn't say that it's not possible.
Right.
Like the technology is probably there. Yeah. The technology is probably there. What they're telling us is that no.
Yeah.
And I am definitely becoming a conspiracy theorist by the end of this episode.
I love the conspiracy. I mean, maybe it's possible that a passenger hijacked the plane, right? But the timing of everything does not point to that. And because of like, again, this good night and like the specificity of like changing over to the air, but you know, I suppose it's possible.
How creepy is it that his last words were good night? And if the hypoxia theory is true, if he raised elevations, they would have, I guess, looked like they were sleeping.
It's so creepy.
Chilling.
It's so chilling and creepy. I can't.
Now, you guys who have read the big, long Atlantic article, was there any sort of investigation into the passenger list and if the backgrounds of any of these people, if they were capable of flying, that kind of thing?
Yes. From what I saw, that they did investigate the passengers. There were two people on the plane who had fake passports.
Ooh.
But I believe that they were just using them as a immigration kind of.
Okay.
It wasn't people who had criminal records or
right. Okay.
Like that.
Okay.
We should put a third party hijacking as a possibility, but I feel like had that happened, first of all, what would have been the point, right?
Yeah.
To hijack this plane and then
fly it, yeah,
disappear
into the ocean, yeah,
right? Because usually there's a purpose for a hijacking.
Yeah,
right. You're taking
right.
a plane hostage
right.
for something,
right. Unless it was an accident. But again, the flight simulation, you know, is always there to make it feel like this wasn't necessarily a hijacking by someone else, but yeah, there was like an accident and so everybody died and then the plane just like flew itself into the Indian Ocean.
So a botched attempt at a
botched hijacking.
Hijacking.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Let's put botched hijacking up on the board just because we need stuff up there.
It's it's possible, you know, there's also the possibility that it was shot down.
Mm. I mean, that was an early theory. Wasn't there another Malaysian flight that was actually shut down time period?
Wasn't it in the Ukraine? Can you look that up?
Yes.
It was like a few months later. It was, I forget who it was shot down, but I think it was over the,
it was, it was the Ukraine. Yeah, Malaysian flight Airlines 17. Flight 17, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Jeez.
Shot down by Russian controlled forces. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, we can also put human error up on the board because we don't know.
Right.
I mean, I don't know, mental health issues. Going on with this guy and like lack of, I don't know.
The
support?
Pilot mental health. I mean, recently there was a pilot story in the news where,
yes,
right? There was the pilot who, I guess it's common for pilots to fly in the third seat in the cockpit.
Yes.
If they're going back and forth from cities and it's a courtesy almost sometimes that they offer if they have to get back to another airport. And there was that pilot who sat in the third seat
And tried to take control and
kind of like nosedive. Right. And
they
having some kind of psychotic break.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He also had done drugs, like some kind of a psychedelic drug. I'm not sure if he was still on them or had, but very recently done them. So
yes.
I mean, people find the planes are literally just people.
Yeah.
That they're just humans with their ups and their downs and their life and their own complications. Like you kind of have to like compartmentalize that. You just think, no, this is like, they're very serious and robotic and, you know, meticulous about it. But sometimes they just have a bad day and they have to fly 200 people across the country.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, I feel like we have a good board, as good as possible, unless there's anything else you want to throw up before we cross things off. I think it's going to be a quick one. So let's take a quick break and start knocking things off the board.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer.
Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's R-E-B-A-G.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay, who's to blame for the tragedy of the Malaysian Airlines Flight 370? Is it the pilot, air traffic control, Malaysian government, not following through on protocol, radar dead zones, hypoxia, flying too close to the sun, national embarrassment / plane pride, remote control hijacking, third party passenger hijacking, botched hijacking, plane shot down, human error, or mental health complications?
Mm-hmm.
This is the impossible task. But what do you think, alarmist? What do you think we should do here?
Well, I do feel like flying too close to the sun can come off the board.
I do think that hypoxia as well, because it seems like that's a symptom of what is happening. It wasn't like necessary to blame for the crash.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unless, you know, because even like if the plane malfunctioned and just went 40,000 feet into the air, that would still be like a plane malfunction. It wouldn't be hypoxia's fault, right?
Yeah.
That's just like what happens when you go too high.
Right.
It feels like national embarrassment / plane pride is also kind of in the like, you know, a result of the tragedy versus maybe something that caused it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. Plane pride is a great term, though.
It is.
It is. I really like it.
It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I also know that it could happen, I guess, but I don't know about remote control hijacking.
It's unlikely.
Yeah, well, if the plane cannot, well, we just have to believe the government that they tell us that planes are not built with the kind of thing that's like could be controlled remotely.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, it's just believe your governments. Super easy, right?
It's true. But it does make you think like, you know, like Teslas like that have like self-driving capabilities, like they can probably be controlled remotely.
Sure. Probably.
They just all got recalled because of something to do with the, you know, exactly that, like the driverless driving, like technology, like it's all wrong.
And it's not all Teslas. Really? There are other.
Oh yeah.
There are other self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. But anything that sort of connects remotely to a satellite can, I don't know. It just freaks me out.
Yeah. Agreed. I guess we have to decide whether we think hijacking is a real possibility here too, because there's other hijacking options. So like those, the botched hijacking or the third party passenger hijacking could come off if we're like, this probably wasn't a hijacking.
I don't know. I don't believe that it was a hijacking because I feel like we would have either heard, I feel like there would have been more of a chaos on the plane.
No contact at all kind of seems to rule that out.
Right. No one used their phone. No one tried to, I don't know, contact there was, a loved one.
And there wasn't even like a person making a demand to air, like usually they would contact air traffic control and say, we've taken over this plane. We're landing here.
Right.
Here's our list of demands or whatever it is.
And that kind of leads me to consider the fact that this was had to be sort of a planned, intentional event because you got to think the pilot in this case wouldn't allow, like in sort of impromptu sort of catastrophes, there's like moments of confusion. And like you're saying, there's like the possibility that, I mean, maybe somebody could have reached out to someone. Mm-hmm. Is that possible on a plane though? Flying it out? If there's like not even radar capability, like can somebody?
Yeah, but that, when it got hijacked, it wouldn't have been in an area that would have been like it was on its, it was flying over Vietnam. So it wasn't
in a dead zone.
Over the dead zone. So it's possible that they could have tried to contact someone.
Yeah.
I mean, just from what we know about like 9/11, people on the plane were, and that was in 2001.
They called,
they called their loved ones from cell phones. So I would assume in 2014, it would be even easier. And a lot of these planes have entertainment. They have Wi-Fi on the flight, which is actually one of the reasons why they were able to track. So apparently those systems have their own satellites.
Oh, wow.
And that's how they were able to figure out the path. Because they had shut down all of the radars on the plane. So air traffic control couldn't find them. But later on, it was the company that provided the entertainment system that was able to give a more accurate path.
It was like pinging off of their towers or something.
Or
satellite, maybe.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Okay.
So should we put down like plane shot down? Like we can take that off the board because I just don't think that we have enough evidence.
And the radar, like dead zone, that's just.
It's bad, but we don't. Yeah.
I mean, it's just scary to think about.
Yeah.
I feel like human error too is just a little vague for what we've been discussing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree.
Now, we're left with the pilot, air traffic control, Malaysian government not following through on protocol, which I think can fold into the traffic control.
Sure.
Not following through on protocol. And then mental health complications. And really, now I don't know where to go because we just don't have answers.
I know. It's like even if we pick something, there's nothing really, I don't know, satisfying about it in some way because we don't, it's such a mystery, right? Like we just don't know. I don't mean that in like a, it's not interesting or to think about or talk about, but it's like, it's so bizarre to be in this position when you're trying to lay blame. I mean, I really like mental health for something, but I'm not sure if it carries enough weight to go to jail. Right. I feel like, but it's, I'm having a hard time wanting to take it off. Malaysian government, I don't know. I would love to blame them for something, but
it seems we could focus more on instead of trying to like get the person like, you know, we solved crack the case. It's more just like maybe we throw a person or thing in jail for like the incompetence fact, you know, element of it all or something.
Yeah.
I mean, if that were the case, then the biggest mix up came from the air traffic controls on both ends, both. Mm-hmm. Malaysian and Kuala Lumpur and Ho Chi Minh.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
I still have a hard time blaming them because of that initial question of what do they do if they think the plane has been, someone is going rogue or taking control of the plane and taking it off course. What would air traffic control do?
Yeah. First episode we don't blame anyone?
Well, actually, we just had an episode where we didn't put anybody in the alarmist jail, didn't we?
Mm. We talked about it, but then
we ended up putting somebody in the alarmist jail.
We wouldn't dare.
Well, do you feel uncomfortable putting the pilot in jail because there's no definitive evidence?
I feel like it was the pilot. That's everything I've read, everything points in that direction, and I just can't get over the simulator part.
I totally agree. The simulator to me is like that the hardest evidence we could, or you know, the closest thing we have to like really hard evidence.
The pilot is in charge of everyone's safety. Like that is their job, right? So even if it wasn't intentional, something serious happened.
What we were just talking about, sort of remote controlled airplanes, the reason why the pilot is there is, or rather the reason why we don't have remote controlling is because of pilots. They want a human being in charge there. So
we're running out of time. I feel like I'm going to blame the pilot. We're sending the pilot, Captain Zahari, to the alarmist jail.
Okay. Right. What do you want to slap?
And I do think we slap, well, as much as I want to slap mental health complications, I feel like that's speculation too.
Okay. So maybe we slap something.
Air traffic control, because at least, or the Malaysian government for withholding all of the information.
I kind of want to slap the Malaysian government for just the way they tried. They didn't completely, they weren't upfront about all the things that they knew in the beginning, but that's just me.
Okay.
And you could fold traffic control into the government because that's usually like federally or like state. Right.
True. I feel
at least for the regulated Malaysian side. Yeah.
I feel bad for those air traffic controllers.
I know. Mm-hmm. I know. But you also got to follow protocol.
I know.
But they are human. Okay, well, I'm going to call it. Malaysian government, you're getting the big slap. The pilot, Captain Zahari, you're going to the alarmist jail. And again, that there's a big question mark next to all of these, but
so should you say, Captain Zahari, you're going to the alarmist jail?
We did.
Like as a question.
Oh. I'm like, we just did that.
It's a mystery. Yeah.
Well, Stosh, thank you so much for helping us try to figure this one out. It was impossible, but we did our best.
We did. Thank you for allowing me to relive one of the worst nightmares that has ever played out in this, real life.
And this is going to come out during, like, right after the holidays when everyone's flying back.
Oh, God.
Oh, good.
Home. So,
did we do that intentionally?
I don't know. Doesn't feel right.
Really, that is so funny. Oh, my God. Flying just gets worse and worse.
Yeah. Sorry about that. We apologize. In the aftermath, in November of this year, 2023, hearings began in Beijing for relatives of the Chinese passengers aboard Flight 370. The state media reported that more than 40 relatives were seeking between 10 and 80 million yuan in compensation, the equivalent of 1.4 and 11.2 million American dollars. The Alarmist is now on Patreon. Subscribe and get ad-free content along with bonus episodes. Go to patreon.com/thealarmist or check out the link in our show description. Visit our website, www.thealarmistpodcast.com, and follow us on Instagram, @thealarmistpodcast, and on Twitter, @alarmistthe. You can also send us your thoughts via email to thealarmistpodcast@gmail.com. Today's episode was produced and engineered by Clayton Early with editing by Molly Hockey and fact-checking by Chris Smith. Thank you to our associate producer and researcher, Crystal Dinsberg. The Alarmist is executive produced by Rebecca Delgado-Smith. Tune in next week. We'll be discussing the Kendall Jenner Pepsi commercial. The Alarmist.
Powered by ACAST.
the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.